Well, thank you, John. It's a delight for me to participate in the symposium honoring Maurice and Katie. Although I never had the privilege of working directly with them, they've been very influential in my own life. I was in a formative stage of my career as a graduate student at the University of Illinois when their first papers on chrysopid dipoles appeared in 1969 and 70. And I mean, I ate them up. I thought they were wonderful pieces of work. And I've been reading their papers ever since, and really wonderful, absolutely wonderful papers. And during that time, we had a seminar series on dipoles at Illinois that I participated in. And I got the draw of choosing to present some of the Tauber's work and to critically analyze that. And it's sort of good news and bad news. The good news was, I mean, these were absolutely wonderful papers to talk about. The bad news was that many of my graduate student colleagues were, you know, in previous weeks having such fun trashing all these other papers and finding fault with all the issues that were raised and being very critical, showing how smart they were by being able to ding these other papers. But you know, when it was my turn to talk about the Tauber's papers, I couldn't find anything to ding on them. They were so good. And I still feel that way. Those of you who know their work recognize that through the years, just produced, you know, asked very good questions, defined those questions very well, presented them extremely well, and just made wonderful contributions to the literature. And I thank you for all your wonderful contributions to dipoles, as well as all the other things. Well, my topic today is a little strange. Why study? I just want to share a little bit about some of my perspectives of why it might be interesting to why we should be interested in dipoles. And unlike Jeff's paper, the talk that was laden with all kinds of data, I have hardly any data to talk about. I'm just going to ramble a little bit about why I think dipoles is interesting. And of course, you know, it's a fun project. I mean, life is good when you're studying dipoles and chrysopids to put it together. Now, funding agencies should fund us just because it's a fun question and some of those sorts of things. That isn't the case. There have to be some other reasons that dipoles is interesting. There's no question about that. Of course, dipoles is so central to the life history of any organism. Usually it's just a short period, maybe a couple months, where the insect can actually actively reproduce and feed, and the bulk of the year is spent in dipoles. So this is a pretty important part of the insect life cycle. Well, as a number of others have paid tribute to this book, I also want to. I just happened to have my camera in the lab the other day and walked down the hall, saw some of my students poring over this book and what they're reading, and here it was, the Tauber book. And I encounter this happens all the time. No, actually, it's a required reading by anyone who enters my lab. And yeah, it was free even. I refer to it all the time. It's good, although it was published in, you know, 86, it's still timely today. I mean, the basis, the foundational work was there. Sure, there are a lot of more experiments that have been done in the meantime, but this is still foundational. It's a timeless sort of thing. And this is where, although most of my students are doing things in sort of the molecular regulation of dipoles these days, this is where they need to start to put that dipoles into context of what it really means to the animal. Well, okay, some of my rambling thoughts of why dipoles is important, we need not say much more about this. Jeff covered it elegantly. As you know, the studies starting with Walsh and on to Bush and his progeny, including Jeff and others, this wonderful story of speciation, incipient speciation, that from Ragulitis, as the fly Ragulitis pomonella makes that transition from hawthorns to apple. This is a wonderful story. I certainly need not say any more about that after Jeff's elegant presentation. But it's a wonderful, I mean, as I see it, this is basically a dipole story. You have to figure out how to come out a bit early, regulate the timing of your dipoles. When you do that, you can, sure, you can become a new species if you want to. So a lot of neat potential there. Of course, a lot of, and certainly a lot of the Tauber's work focused on The idea of when you talk about biological control agents, it's very important to be able to have make sure that that biological control agent is coordinated in its life history with that of the host. When you have them coordinated, you of course can hope to get some control. When they are not coordinated, it is not a good arrangement, and obviously there's not much point in releasing a species for biological control if it's not very finely tuned to the phenology of the host. And again, this is a very critical question for where these hosts come, or where the parasitoids may come from, and how they can be coordinated with the seasonal cycle of the host. Absolutely critical. Of course, the diapause durations and the time of entry into diapause is so critical for population modeling. Just to cite a few papers here with the gypsy moth and a few other species that have to take into consideration very clearly how when diapause is going to be broken, how this changes with different times, different seasonal changes from one year to another will influence the determination of diapause, which in turn is so important for developing good population models for regulation of insect development and population density. Can we possibly manipulate diapause for control purposes? Frankly, in the lab, we have all sorts of tools that work very nicely for manipulating diapause. We can prevent diapause with some chemical tricks. We can make them enter diapause a bit early. We can make them break out a bit later. And all those things, if translated into the field, could indeed be a form of ecological suicide that could be rather attractive to try to apply. Now, frankly, there have not been that many cases where people have actually exploited this in the field. These are a couple of examples with the apple blossom weevil, some work by Jan Žďárek in the Czech Republic, applying juvenile hormone to the barks of trees and the beetles go down. This is an adult reproductive diapause that is regulated by juvenile hormone. The shutdown of JH is normally what puts them into diapause. They walk over a barrier with JH as they depart from the tree. They take up the GH, they start reproducing instead of going into diapause. So kind of a cute story. Likewise, Jim Kreisen's work with the Paracilla is an example of where it has been used, at least to some extent. Now, I'm still intrigued with the possibility that there may be some other neat things that one can do here. We're playing a little bit in my lab at this point with diapause hormone, and these are a couple of the only data slides I have. Several years ago when Weihua Zhu was in my laboratory spending a sabbatical, we started looking at diapause hormone. Some of you will probably remember, diapause hormone is a hormone well known from the commercial silk moth. It is a hormone that actually puts the silk moth, Bombyx mori, into diapause, into its embryonic diapause. Well, we were aware that that same gene was present in a lot of other Lepidoptera as well, so Weihua tried to put these Heliothus helicoverpa species into diapause by injecting diapause hormone into them. That did not work at all, but it breaks diapause instead, and actually the bottom, it's bottom, figure here shows that we could terminate diapause rather readily, about 93% or so with 100 picomoles of this diapause hormone. So here's this rather strange thing that in Bombyx mori, this neuropeptide puts them into diapause. In these Helicoverpa species and Heliothus, it actually breaks them out of diapause. And we have a lot of nice data showing the expression of the gene is shut off during diapause, and diapause termination, it comes up again. So pretty robust action. So what we're rather interested in looking if this might have some potential for insect control. This, again, just shows the dose response curve for diapause hormone in breaking the pupil diapause. It shows the sequence of the diapause hormone that we have from Zia on the bottom. But it shows an ED50 about 100 picomoles to get this response of diapause termination by injection. So more recently, we've been looking at ways we might be able to manipulate that neuropeptide, maybe alter it, make some changes, and see if we can get something that's more active than diapause hormone. And indeed, in this figure you'll see the table show you with diapause hormone. Again, our old ED50, the hormone itself breaks, has ED50 about 100 picomoles. But we have several very active compounds here that will break diapause at way more potency than the native diapause hormone. These are compounds that are rather strange. They do not look at all like, some of them don't look at all like the diapause hormone itself. The three most active ones are this one, and this one. And they appear to, I didn't want to go there, okay. These compounds appear to prevent the breakdown of the normal, it fits into the diapause hormone receptor, but it can't be broken down as readily, so hence you extend the half-life of it greatly. And now we're trying to see if we might be able to use these compounds to perhaps prevent diapause, maybe put it into the food, or maybe there'd be something there that could actually be inserted into the plant that might prevent the actual entry into diapause of these really important agriculturally agriculturally important insects. Okay, enough for the data, on to other stuff. another aspect of control, this is a paper that George Yocum brought to my attention just a couple months ago. It appeared recently on with Colorado potato beetle. Result that I'm a little surprised, I wouldn't have anticipated something like this, but in this case, the Colorado potato beetle, if they've, they mate with using stored sperm that had been in the female's body through the winter, the resistance is much higher than if the females mate in the spring. So ones that have not carried sperm over through the winter, the resistance is much lower. So there's a kind of an interesting over a 2.5-fold difference in resistance as a result of the diapause fate of the female. So again, an aspect that I wouldn't have thought of that comes into play and could be rather important in resistance management. Of course, throughout the world, there are in many places other than the United States, it's more important than it is here, but managing domestic species. There are lots of bumblebees used, especially in Korea and throughout Asia, as pollinators, greenhouses and other places. Solitary bees, important for some pollination work, and of course the silk moth, both the commercial silk moth bombyx, as well as there's a whole industry, rather important industry growing up in India and other places of using some of the native silk moths for the silk industry. Most of those species have pupal diapauses that have to be manipulated if these small producers are going to be successful in managing the species. So again, diapause in all these cases is very critical to the management of the species. And I certainly want to pay tribute to what I consider one of the major reasons one studies diapause and go back to pay tribute to some very foundational studies in insect endocrinology. And indeed, it was Carol Williams' work with the Cecropia diapausing pupae that laid the groundwork for our understanding of the brain and the prothoracic glands' action in that important role in metamorphosis. And Jan de Wilde's work with the diapausing adults of the Colorado potato beetle that laid the groundwork so impressively for our understanding how juvenile hormone regulates regulates reproduction in adult females. Just absolutely foundational work in endocrinology there. And as I already alluded to, diapause hormone in the silk moth, that was first discovered by Fukuda in the silk moth. And it really still is probably our best known, best understood neuropeptide hormone. There's been just a absolutely wonderful amount of work, wealth of work, especially in Japan on this hormone. So they've really very foundational work. And of course, diapause is such a neat story where you have this wonderful cessation of development. You can probe it from an endocrinological perspective very nicely to look how you can initiate it and how you can bring them out of this. So it's been a wonderful tool for investigating fundamental questions in insect endocrinology. Okay, this is maybe a little more tenuous linked to aging. There have been studies using C. elegans, the dour state, which is essentially the C. elegans equivalent of diapause, and some Mark Tatter's work on Drosophila melanogaster, exploiting the somewhat of a diapause in melanogaster to address some issues of aging. And I think there's some real potential here. I mean, when you think of, I look at diapause essentially as an aging issue. I mean, you have a non-diapausing animal that may go through its life in 1 month, whereas a diapausing insect may go 9 or 10 months. I mean, this is the entomological equivalent of making a human live 800 years. And what's not to like about this? I mean, could be more interested in this field of research all the time. It's getting more interesting all the time. I think there's some neat things here, but maybe it's just because my hair is gray as well. But at any rate, I think there's some neat potential there. And is it a model for obesity? I think it might be. I think there's some very interesting things that insects do in preparation of diapause that could parlay into some interesting things in obesity. I mean, this is, of course, an epidemic that is widespread in our country today, as you know. And a number of insects, when they enter diapause, they're making a decision. Am I going to go into diapause? And if so, should I pack on more fat? So there's a very interesting set point there for many of these insects that will say, yes, I need to bring on more weight. And understanding that set point of how they make that decision is pretty important. I give here just an example of some fat differences in flies. We don't know that that's true now. We're re-looking at that. But certainly for many other insects, it is definitely true that there's some very dramatic increases in fat reserves. There are also some very interesting points of fat regulation downstream during diapause. You must very carefully make sure you're measuring the amount of lipid you still have in your body, in the flesh flies we do a lot of work on. About midway through diapause, they stop using fat and then shift over to non-fat utilization for the rest of diapause. You have to retain a certain amount of fat in order to get through the rest of metamorphosis. So I think that set point too of deciding when I've utilized enough fat is quite interesting as well. I think diapause offers some interesting issues and questions in potentially tools for blocking disease transmission. I use here the case of Culex pipiens and West Nile virus. Culex pipiens enters an adult diapause in wintertime. It appears that one of the ways that West Nile virus gets through the from one season to the other is being retained in the adult females that are diapausing. Now, it's also interesting that virus in the mosquito that's in diapause stops replication. And then when diapause is terminated in the spring, replication is initiated again. So there's some sort of a factor there that I think is certainly suppressing viral replication in the case of West Nile virus. In the case of La Crosse virus, that's another case where, in that case, the virus is within the egg of, well, I'll call it Aedes triseriatus because I can never remember the new name for that genus. But in triseriatus, that La Crosse virus spends the winter there. And again, the virus stops replicating in that egg during diapause. When diapause is terminated, replication begins. So might be some fun cues and things to look at here. This is another area that I think is terribly important, increasing the shelf life of biological control agents. There are a lot of rather small industries growing up in this country and others that trying to exploit biological control agents for control. And the challenge that many of these people have is trying to maintain the shelf life. You're not going to have much of a commercial product if your organism develops too quickly, or you can't store it adequately in time to get to the person who wants to use it. So I think there's certainly some potential here in exploiting diapause mechanisms to keep those animals dormant until you want them to be released and to be used in the field. So again, understanding those mechanisms, I think, is potentially terribly important. And then there's cryopreservation. This is a chemically induced dormancy that pictured here is Roger Leopold from Fargo, North Dakota. I saw him a minute ago. I don't know where he may be. Oh, there he is. Absolutely the dean of insect cryopreservation. And Roger and his group are making some really absolutely wonderful progress with this technique. And, you know, this is so important. I think both cryopreservation as well as the other, my last slide, things that you could do to increase the shelf life. I mean, so many different strains, new transgenic lines and things are, it's so becoming so challenging to be able to maintain all of these different lines. And if you could cryopreserve them, or if you could somehow increase the shelf life by other tricks involving diapause or others, that would be very, 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 very important to many of the great tools for science. I mean, Drosophila people would absolutely love it for sure. And I have to wonder if indeed a number of these diapausing insects do indeed have, well, most of them are not freeze tolerant. There are a few that are, but understanding the mechanisms of freeze tolerance in some of those really cold hardy organisms, I think could have some insights and that they could be perhaps exploited for cryopreservation. I think it's a terribly important area. And just a couple slides here on what I'll call pharmacological prospecting. You know, when insects go into diapause, they have they mount a rather impressive array of stress-related responses. They generate a number of defense sorts of mechanisms, and there have been a number of neat compounds taken out of diapausing insects so far. The cecropin's been around for quite some time, taken from diapausing pupae of Hylophora cecropia, has such toxicity against mammalian tumors. Elaferrin, a paper appeared a few years ago from diapausing larvae of Calliphora vicinia that can induce interferon synthesis in humans and enhance antiviral and anti-tumor resistance. Some neat compounds there that have actually been field tested in some, well, they call it field tested, hospital tested in Russia. Yamamarin's an example of a compound from Anthria yamamai that suppresses cell proliferation in rat hematoma cells. And diapausin is it comes out of a leaf beetle that has some neat antifungal activity. And I think we've just, you know, scratched the surface of this now. I mean, there's so many different diapausing insects and so many different compounds that have been recruited and made by these organisms that I think have some wonderful opportunity for exploiting. One other thing that I didn't mention here, and I just came out in a conversation with Dan Hahn and I had a couple of days ago, you know, one of the issues with a stroke victim or cardiovascular problems, you know, often involves a shortage of oxygen to the cells during a heart attack or a stroke. Insects often have to deal with hypoxic situations well in diapause. And there are indeed, we have a number of, actually we have at least one gene that is hypoxia upregulated in our flies that, you know, has some kind of interesting implications for some work like that. So there could be some things along that line that may be of interest as well. Well, okay, I have not, the only data I really talked about today was some the neuropeptide stuff by Chiri Zhang, the other people here in my lab. I would, however, if you're interested in some of the more things that our lab is very interested in, I point you to a couple talks that are going to occur tomorrow in the symposium honoring another giant in the diapause field, Mike Chippendale. Dan Hahn, who's here in the audience, I saw a smiling face back there, that Jeff is collaborating a bit with Jeff. Dan was a postdoc in my lab, and we together have just finished a really neat EST project on sarcophaga. We now have 10,000 genes or so that we're, you know, playing with, and I think we're, you know, I'm just really excited by what's happening there. So Dan will be presenting some of that data on sarcophaga tomorrow morning in symposium honoring Mike. And then in one of my current postdocs, Rob Michaud, we'll be talking about some of our metabolomics work then, and you know, how we're looking forward to integrating the transcriptomics and the metabolomics that that Rob is doing. So Rob will be actually substituting for Jack Dilworth, who was supposed to be in that symposium tomorrow. It looks like my time is up, and I'm done anyway, so this works well. So thanks about Katie and Reese. It's been wonderful. Thanks.